Welcome to the Personal Financial Planning Section podcast, delivering insights from experts on tax, retirement, estate, risk management, investment planning, and practice management, designed to help you best serve your clients and take your practice to the next level. I'm your PFP section host, Sarah Bradley. Be sure to visit us at aicpa.org/PFP and stay tuned at the end of the episode for information on how to access valuable resources. And now over to our guests.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm Michael Goodman, and I'm here to talk about succession planning. We've talked about the different elements of succession planning, and today we're going to go into G2, or Generation 2. These are the folks that are now working with Generation 1, or the founders of the firms, to transition the firm to the next generation. Super excited to be joined by two G2 members that have some great experience in working with this transition that we've been talking about. The first is Eric Heyman, who's at Austin Asset Management, and who's actually gone as far as to write a book from the perspective of G2. Additionally, we have Chris Benson from LK Benson & Company, who's also working on a transition to G2 with his unique twist of working in a business that was founded by his father. So he's working on a G2 transition, but even with different elements that relate to working with family. So I think the best way to get started, guys, is to just give us a little bit of your background. You know, feel free to take a little bit of time, talk about sort of how you got into the business a little bit, but more importantly, how you found yourself as a potential G2 person as you started working in this firm and what that was like. You know, take a couple of minutes to do that. Obviously, you'll have different stories based on your perspectives. So, Eric, why don't you go first and give us a little bit of a feel for that?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. So thanks for having me. And from my perspective, the way I started was I didn't know what job I wanted in college. And so I just happened to reach out to the founder of Austin Asset. His name was John Henry McDonald. And I wanted to understand how he did what he did on a daily basis. And so I met with him on an afternoon after classes one day and said, do you mind if I just come back to the office next week and just hang out and follow you around, essentially just to learn what he did on a daily basis, to find out if it was something I wanted to do after I graduated. I had two semesters left in college, and that's how it started. And so I didn't really get into the profession thinking that I was going to become a CFP or even to this day be the CEO of the firm, but that I was really attracted to the vision he had for building this firm that he'd basically operated on his own for about 10 years. And so from there, he and I worked together for those years, and this was back in 1997. And so by 2007, the firm had grown quite larger, and we realized that it was time to actually talk about transition and succession planning. And so we started a seven-year transition back in 2007, where I took over as CEO, and he would transition out of client responsibilities, and then he retired a little over 3 years ago. So we've seen over the last 20 years, for me being an unpaid intern and not knowing anything about the business at all and learning how to file statements in the cabinet to then, you know, kind of working through a transition and succession plan with him. So that's the Cliff's Notes version of the story, and we'll certainly dig into the details of it as we talk.
Yeah, that's great, and I'm excited to dig into those details, but that's a great setup. Chris, could you share a little bit about your perspective on this?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Michael. My father, of course, as many of you know, and who is also doing one of these podcasts, started his firm 20 plus years ago. And I think from some perspective, some people might think that maybe that this was kind of a preordained path for me to join the firm and eventually go through this succession planning, which we've been working through now. But it really didn't come about that way, and I certainly never had visions of this growing up. I didn't have visions of this when I went off to college to become an engineer, which didn't happen, obviously, and I wound up in accounting and got my accounting degree, went to a big accountant, public accounting firm and worked in their tax department doing all kinds of different work, and still at that point had no real visions of joining my dad. I knew what he did. I always was interested in the investment work that he does, and I understood the financial planning that he does. And I guess over time, I spent 5 years at Grant Thornton in public accounting, and I got to specializing in working with small, closely held businesses and individuals on the tax side. And I saw what he saw, I think, which was that there was a lot more that we could have been doing there to help our clients. And that's why he started the firm. And we started having more and more discussions about what I could have been doing at Grant Thornton to help those clients and what he was doing with his clients. And eventually we got to a point where, you know, he had grown the firm and he thought he could bring somebody else on. And we started to have these lunches where we'd sit down and talk through what it would look like if I joined him. And eventually we took that step. And when I started here, you know, I was still mostly, primarily kind of a sole practitioner. He has support staff and he has someone on the tax side and he has someone on the investment side, and we're still pretty small. But he kind of ran most of the business, and I came in almost as an employee, what I was used to at an accounting firm, and kind of took that role as an employee. And I think I kind of had that employee mentality at first of just doing what's always been done here and, you know, learning about the financial planning work that he does and learning about the investment work and kind of taking that employee mentality. And I think over time I grew into a different role, and we'll dig into, you know, how that transition happened. And now we're not as through the succession plan yet. We're in the midst of it, and we're working through that. So I think from that perspective, I don't have the final answer, but I think I have learned a lot in this transition, and I'm happy to share that with you all.
That's great. Thank you, Chris. Wonderful to get that perspective from both of you, and I'm excited to dig in deeper and get to the nooks and crannies and sort of how that all went about. So maybe one of the best first questions, and please, I rely on both of your experiences to take this conversation where you think it should go, but as a G1 guy myself, I'm sort of wondering for both of you, and we'll just keep the order we've been doing here. So, Eric, you can go first. Is, well, who initiated that conversation? When did that realization actually come about? Well, we got to talk about this transition. Who initiated that conversation? Was it easy? Was it hard? Did it take several attempts? How did it develop? You know, give us a feel for getting started in that process.
Okay, so I'm gonna go ahead and lead with a really good story about kind of how it started. So when I came to the firm, John Henry had the firm for about 10 years, and he operated essentially on his own. He had a helper in the office that had been with him for a while, but the firm's revenue was $150,000 a year. I mean, it was a small practice, but he really wanted it to be a bigger business, which meant, you know, things like operational issues and administrative issues were kind of left to the side because the focus was on actually doing the service for the client. So when I came into the firm, my very first jobs, even as an unpaid intern and then and finally being paid, were just to organize the office. And so he would joke that he would call me Radar because I had this essentially like a clipboard that I would walk around the office with, because I was just trying to get an understanding of how things came together in the office. And I went to him once, this was probably about 12 months after I'd started, and he had me start to reconcile QuickBooks because we hadn't been reconciled for many months, and we had invoices that were outstanding that we weren't sure who should be paying them or if we'd even mailed them out, and just basic business type of accounting issues. And as I went to him with this concern, because I'd gotten an American Express bill, and it had showed that a purchase for a suit was on it. And I had known that he had been invited to speak at a conference down in the Caribbean, and I thought, well, it's interesting that there's an expense of the suit on the American Express corporate card as I'm reconciling the statement, but it's, I knew he was being paid personally for this kind of speaking engagement. So I went to him with my clipboard, so to speak, and said, John Henry, so here's the thing. So there's a suit expense, but I know you're being paid personally for the speaking engagement. So we kind of have an issue here. I mean, he owned all the company, so it's not like I have any ownership in the company to say this, but this is how this conversation started was, you know, he had asked me to look at the business as if it was my own, and so I recognize that we have this kind of a challenge here around this personal expense. And so I said, either I guess the speaking fee comes into the company, and then the company will pay for the suit, or you reimburse the company for the suit and you keep the speaking fee, because he had asked me to look at the books as if they were my own. So that essentially was the very first conversation we had that related to succession when I look back on it. Because it was the first place where operationally he had to look at the business as if it was a business, not just one he owned, and I had to look at it as a business that one day I would hopefully be running. And so it was not long after that, maybe 6 months after that, that in passing one day he said, you know, one day it's going to be great to work for you. And I kind of laughed about it and we joked about it, but it was because operationally the firm really needed someone to pay attention to those details. And so that was probably the very first time succession conversations came up, but it wasn't like in the overt way. It was just a very subtle shift of how he looked at the firm and how I looked at my role in the firm. And then it was about 2 years after that initial conversation that I first bought 10% of the company from him in late 99. So about 2.5 years after I started, where we actually then began the conversation, you know, maybe you should focus on operational. That would be your value add to the business instead of becoming a planner and taking on new clients. But that your value to me as the founder of the firm is to actually help organize and grow the business from an operational and management side. And so that really was, you know, kind of how it started. Was it really started with that suit conversation, where I was scared enough to go to him and stick my neck out and say, you know, you own all this, so it's not like I have any right to tell you this, but you've asked me to pay attention to this as if it was my own, and so I feel like I owe you to have that conversation. So that's kind of how it. That, I'd say that was the very first triggering conversation when I look back and connect the dots.
Well, that's actually very poignant, because if you think about it for a second, there's so much more that could go on from that experience as far as you getting that's a key turning point in you getting an understanding of his mentality about how the business should run, about how he feels about those things, and how that ultimately might lead to something for you in the business you might want to own it someday. That was a chance to really point this issue out, which he could have went in different directions in his response, which might have really impacted whether or not you'd even want to be a successor.
Well, you're exactly right. And what I would say too in that is that, you know, fortunately early on, you know, he was one of my very first mentors. I mean, I was a young kid right in college, and so he was kind of the first professional mentor I'd had. And so there was this conversation around, we had enough emotional deposits in each other's lives, meaning he had spoken into me in terms of helping me learn what it meant to be a professional and work in his business. And then I had also kind of made emotional deposits into him in terms of encouraging him to do what he was really great at and let me deal with the things that were behind the scenes. And so, but it was one of those conversations where it had emotion in it, it had financial issues in it, and it also had operational impacts. And so it could have gone really bad, but fortunately we were both aligned around what's best for the business. And if we're going to run this like a business and hire people and pay them, then we have to pay attention to how we care for our personal expenses, even though he owned the business.
So, Chris, you might not have a story like that, and your story might be completely different because of, you know, it being your dad and all. But, you know, what was the initiation of a conversation around succession for you guys? How did that get brought up, and, you know, who brought it up, and what did that feel like for you?
Yeah, and I don't have there wasn't one turning point. There wasn't one story that I can tell that really, I guess, flipped things for us from me being an employee to talking about that succession plan. I think when I started here, once I came over here, because we had quite a few discussions about me even joining the firm, we kind of had that vision that eventually that's what would happen. Again, it's a small firm here. There aren't any other advisors. So it was either I join and take on that role eventually, or it just becomes a lifestyle practice down the road. So I think that was kind of the background. So we both kind of knew that would happen eventually, but we didn't say it, which, you know, it can be a bad thing, but eventually somebody has to say something. So I think those first few years while I was here, you know, I felt from my perspective, being the boss's son, I didn't want to come in and act like I'm entitled to anything and I'm going to inherit the business one day and I'll be the boss. And, you know, both from a client perspective and an employee's perspective, I wanted to earn my stripes here, even though I had spent 5 years in public accounting and knew what I was doing. I wanted to show everybody here that I did, that I could take on that kind of role. So, you know, those first few years, I didn't push anything. I took my time. I learned as much as I could. I kind of involved myself in the business and became more ingrained in the clients' lives and the other employees' lives before we really started to have that discussion. And I think, you know, before we even talked about the succession, was emergency planning kind of scenario. You know, what happens in it's my dad, and the last thing I want to think about is anything bad happening to him. But we had that discussion that this proverbial bus that might hit him any day of the week while he's crossing the street, he doesn't like to think about that bus, but I brought it up to him and I said, well, what would happen if, God forbid, something happened to you? And that kind of started that discussion, and we started having weekly or sometimes weekly, sometimes monthly sit downs where we talk about the future, both of the firm, because we wanted to create a vision of the firm that we both could buy into, and then how we get to the point where I'm taking over part of the firm. So, you know, I think that that scare tactic of what could happen in a worst case scenario. And, you know, my dad likes to travel a lot. So he would be, you know, off in Turkey in a hot air balloon. And I'd say, if you're going to go off to Turkey in a hot air balloon, I need to know what's going to happen if something happened to that balloon, God forbid. So that kind of triggered some discussions, I think some deeper discussions that otherwise we had in the back of our minds, but we just hadn't formalized.
Interesting. So one of the things that I think I'm realizing from this process, being such a process-oriented person and thinking a lot of people in our profession are process-oriented, is that a lot of the initial steps of the way this conversation gets started is not so on the surface. It's a lot of subconscious or unsaid things that are sort of happening within the business with each other, act behaviors that we're seeing, as well as some conversations that don't involve specifically the words of succession or transition, but there are conversations around that that we all need to be more sensitive to. So I would say to G1, you know, be aware of that. That's something that G2 is thinking about and feeling that you might not even realize getting communicated during that process. Do you guys agree? Either one of you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I would agree, though, that the, you know, succession for us, at least in the eyes of John Henry as the founder, was a posture. So when you think of how you run a business, I think his approach was, his posture set him in a position where, you know, here am I, this young person who's, we had totally different strengths, but he recognized enough to utilize those strengths early on to make himself better at what he was doing. And so his posture was always towards, how do I make Eric successful and also make the business successful in that? And then by doing that, it makes me successful. And so I think succession is really a posture. So it wasn't like to exactly what Chris is saying and you're saying, is that it wasn't like we had an agenda and he invited me to a calendar meeting that said succession on it. There were just so many things that happened along the way that his posture was always leaning towards how can I best, you know, utilize Eric's strengths and utilize my strengths so that this business can be a better business than it was before. And that ultimately got us to the point where we had conversations around succession, but it wasn't so overt or clear. And in our case, most of those conversations were led really from my end, not because he wasn't open to them, but because I was more the operational management minded of the two of us, whereas he was more the visionary, you know, sales creator influencing type of person. And so it was really a lot of times up to me to kind of identify, here might be an area where we could make some adjustments, and then we would have an open conversation about it, and then all of a sudden look up and realize we're actually doing succession planning, but not, it wasn't so planned and focused and prescriptive as much as it was very much just a posture of how he was approaching the business, always wanting it to be professional and be managed or have it last beyond him. So I totally agree with you.
Yeah, I think that It is very informal, and it's something that takes time. And I think that just in the normal course of business, you're going to encounter situations that are going to lead to that discussion, whether it's direct or not. You know, as I think back, there were times when we'd be taking on a new client or a new prospect would come in, and we'd sit down and we'd meet with them. And then afterwards, we'd discuss them and say, well, is this the kind of client we want? And we'd say, well, I don't know. Is that the kind of client that we want to build our future, the future of the firm around? And all of a sudden you're talking about, well, who is our ideal client, and who, what are we trying to do for clients, and how do we, what does that look like in the future? So, you know, that is an initial stage of succession planning, I think, is building a shared vision of the future. And it happened that way. And also operationally, as I got more ingrained in what we do here, I found things where I wanted to change the way we were doing it, or I thought of new ideas or saw something at a conference that I wanted to implement. And as you start to implement some of these new ideas, new methods, new techniques for working with clients, you realize that you're developing the firm and changing the way that you're working with clients. And all of a sudden you're kind of taking on an operational a role in the firm. And if you're going to take on an operational role and you're kind of taking some of that decision-making process away from the founder, eventually you start to have discussions about who's making that decision and who decides whether we're going to upgrade to this new software or not. And it just kind of happens naturally, and those discussions start to happen naturally. And eventually you have to force the issue a little bit, because it might be, I've heard of situations where founders are really reluctant to take that next step, and they might kind of delay it longer than the G2 would want to see that happen. So at some point you might have to push it, but don't push it too soon.
Interesting. I love this concept of learning about, you know, and even seeing in my own practice, knowing that this happened, but not being as aware, learning about how the conversation was probably years before the actual conversation starts to occur, over the mechanics of the succession and the feelings that sort of build up around that and sort of feeling each other out. So fascinating to me that we've been able to discuss that.
Do you guys remember when Lucasfilm came out with the THX, and you'd go into the movie theater and there'd be all these noises, and all of a sudden this, you know, image would come up on the screen. It would say, you know, the audience is listening, right? It would just be this, the first time you went to the movie theater, and it was just like this amazing sound system. Well, in a lot of ways, what's going on within our firms is the audience is listening. And so they're picking up on all these little cues, whether the meeting is about succession or whether, you know, you're getting the team together or the, you know, one of your G2 people to talk about succession. They're always kind of listening to who's leading the staff meeting and who's designing the agenda for this client. And so in a lot of ways, it's so organic. And I think what sometimes happens for founders and kind of the generation two successors is that they think it's got to be really formal, like that I have to go to the founder with a document that says, let's talk about succession and here's how we're going to do it. Or that the founder feels like they've got to put together some big plan in order to go to their team and talk about how they want to design a succession plan. And the reality is the audience is just always listening. And so they're making up little stories as they connect the dots. And so it's just so much more organic than the formal process that people seem to get stuck on. And I think that's why people just get stuck, is they think it's got to be really formal around, okay, I need to go talk to my son Chris about how he's going to take over the business one day, and how do I even start that conversation? Well, no, it's just these little things, like how do we address this client, like, you know, this new way of serving a client. Those are all little bitty pieces of a succession story, which I think kind of demystifies the whole term, because it's really just a very organic process of allowing someone else's voice to expand so the audience hears them a little bit more than they did before and can pick up on those little subtle cues around, you know, that's a good idea, and so let's run with it. And so I say that because sometimes people get stuck on the succession plan has to be so formalized and so well scripted, when the reality is it usually starts in a very subtle way.
Oh, I agree. I think that's wonderful that it's developed that way for the both of you. I just wonder and sort of hope that it's been the same for other G2 folks, and it hasn't been as clinical or robotic as one might sort of initially assume. So that's important. Let's shift a little bit now to when, okay, we're actually going to start talking about this, and I'd imagine that stereotypically assume that G1 is encouraging, supportive, enthusiastic, but when it comes to sort of the pen having to, you know, reach the paper, the rubber hitting the road, if you will, those metaphors, that they might be a little more slower to act on actually implementing a sort of a transition plan. Chris, do you want to talk about that a little bit in your experience around the actual plan?
Yeah, and again, our plan is still in process. It's not formalized and finalized quite yet, but there's a lot of steps to, I think, the succession plan, as we've talked about, and putting it down on paper and actually signing the on the dotted line is a big step and a big hurdle and something that needs to be done. I think talking about the structure of how that occurs is difficult too, because obviously G1 wants to maximize value, and they've built this great firm and, you know, worked hard for years, and they see a lot of value there. G2 also sees that value, but they might not have the financial means to go out and buy a firm. Most of us don't. We're younger and supporting families, and it's just not, we're not at that level where we can go and do that yet. So I think it's again goes back to a shared vision of the future. In our case, maximizing the value of the firm was never my dad's primary intention, or really one of his intentions. It was more making sure the firm continues on into the future, providing me with the opportunity to take the firm into the future. And the financial side of it has just kind of fell into place. So So I think sitting down and formalizing that is important, and that definitely takes a lot of time. And I think in our case, we have additional considerations because it's my dad. I have two sisters. We have, so as he thinks through his own estate planning, and he's gone through his own financial planning process and thought through what he wants to happen with his estate, and that's all interconnected in this whole process. And, it makes it a little bit more complicated, and that's why you have to take your time and make sure you're both on the same page with everything.
Yeah, it's definitely a different dynamic with family. And as you mentioned, with your sisters sort of outside the business and how that all comes through. So that's surely an additional challenge that one might have to go through. Eric, can you share with us a little bit what that was like for you? And probably even more helpful might be to even also tap into some of the other G2 folks that you've spoken with through your research or your book, maybe, and give us a little perspective of not only your view, but what you've seen some other people go through around this initial conversation of putting the pen to paper.
Yeah, that's good. So for us, the pen to the paper, again, there were, think of different inflection points. So there were conversations that would occur where you could tell the severity of the conversation, the reality of the conversation was becoming more clear, meaning, okay, we're having a discussion around how to make this decision that's very strategic for the firm, and who was going to make that decision became unclear. And so this inertia of, okay, we're getting closer and closer, became almost overwhelming to both of us. And what happened was we both started acting out. I started acting out in fear. And in some ways he did as well, because it was uneasy. Like, we had worked together this was probably 2005. So we'd worked together for seven, eight years. And we could sense that the business was becoming much more operational than it was entrepreneurial. So think of like the Michael Gerber e-myth type of thing, where the firm had survived its early years, and now it's hiring people and it has systems and processes and things that need to be decided on a regular basis about the strategy of the firm. And he and I were both struggling with our identity in that. And that's where the emotional piece came in. And so at that point, I reached out to an outside management consultant we had used on a number of projects and said, we need your help, because between the two of us, we're not sure where we go next. I know I want to run the business. I don't know if John Henry wants me to run the business yet, but we're dealing with some internal challenges around strategic direction. And so he came to the table, this outside resource we had, with this book called Why CEOs Fail. And it talks about 11 behaviors that can derail your climb to the top. And he had us go through this book together, almost like a book study with him, kind of three of us in a room, to talk about how no CEO is perfect and how each of us had something in our behavior, the way we handle things, that could derail the company. But based on where the life cycle of the company was, maybe it was time for Eric to take over as CEO, because his weaknesses would have been more hurtful to the business when it was young, whereas John Henry's strengths were much more beneficial to the company when it was young. But now that the life cycle of the company has changed a little bit, we need someone to sustain it and operate it in an efficient way, and maybe it's best for Eric to be the CEO. And so this was probably a 9-month process that kind of culminated in this document that I put together for John Henry that was called Celebrating Success. And it was essentially here's what the company needs from you, John Henry, and here's your strengths. And here's what the company can offer to you as it relates to a fulfilling role going forward. And that started the formalization of the succession plan that then turned into like a memorandum of understanding that designed the succession plan around the steps of each year and how compensation would change and the role within the office and the hours in the office. But it really started with this book discussion around not one of us is perfect at this. And the more comfortable we are with that fact, the easier it'll be to deal with the succession issue. Because it's not like, because the fear that I had was, could I really do it? And do I really even want this job, even though I said I did? And then maybe in John Henry's world, it was, it's not that I'm bad at this and I don't want to feel like I'm being pushed out. But I also want to be a smart shareholder that has equity in this business. And so that book really diffused both of our emotions, because it took a third party and introduced them to the equation. So that was our story around like how the succession plan came together. What I hear from a lot of my peers is that you get right up to the edge of making someone an owner, and a lot of times I talked about earlier how it was very organic and the audience is listening, you're putting together little pieces. Well, what can happen though is that when a G2 person that's a leader within the firm, that's maybe not an owner, but really making an impact to the business, doesn't ever get the tap on the shoulder that says, let's have a real conversation. then they might get offered equity, say 1% of the company or 2% of the company, and a lot of times that's just window dressing. And it's and I would say it's the successor needs to have more courage to go to the founder, or the Generation 2 person needs to have more courage to go to the founder and say, look, I feel like I'm making an impact here. I'd like to make a further impact. What can I do to influence the future of the firm or the growth of the firm? Because I'm aligned with what you're trying to accomplish, like your vision and mission. That's the role that the Generation 2 person can have. And then from the founder's perspective, it's the awareness and humility to say, you know, I'm not doing all this on my own anymore. And to go to that Generation 2 person and have the conversation, besides just offering them 1% or 2% of equity in the company, but here's how I see you could really impact the firm going forward. And why I bring it up that way is that I know of a number of people, a handful of friends that I have, that were in that very situation and then ended up leaving the firms they're at because the founder could not clearly articulate the role that the Generation 2 person would have over the coming years as it related to succession. And so they left the firm they were at to go to a firm that could clearly articulate the story of how they were going to plan for succession or plan to integrate them as a more meaningful voice in their company. And so that's a real challenge for the Generation 1 leadership right now is the Generation 2 folks are paying attention to this and are watching the leaders kind of fail in some ways as relates to like this book, like kind of like how I was with John Henry. But we also have our own insecurities of could we really make an impact? And so there just needs to be this vulnerability that occurs somewhere in a conversation around, I don't have it figured out either, you know, either person, like the Generation 1 or the Generation 2 person. But if we really care about the business, how can we put aside our own needs and focus on what the business needs right now based on where it's at? And so that's what I hear more from my peer group and from the conversations around the book are that both people have to be comfortable enough with who they are to say, okay, I'm good at this, but I'm not good at that. And I also know I can't do this on my own forever. Like we're all interim. I mean, the CEO that's the CEO of the company right now is still an interim CEO. They won't always be the CEO, either because they'll die while they're the CEO or the business will die before they end their role as a CEO, or something will happen to them that makes it so that just the business doesn't have that role for them anymore. And so we're all interim. And I think a lot of times the founders, the identity is so connected to that founder role that they don't ever think of themselves not being in that role. And that's where this conversation has to be open and transparent enough to say, this is how we start the conversation of actually putting the plan together is, I know that at some point, either if I want the business to outlast me, then someone eventually will be the person making decisions. And that's just the reality of life. But it's really hard to get to that place if the founder and the Generation 2 person don't have this, you know, strong enough emotional kind of relationship, or they've kind of made enough deposits in each other's lives to have that real vulnerable kind of honest discussion.
Chris, anything you want to add to that?
The one thing that Eric mentioned in there was about making sure that he wanted this job, and that kind of stood out to me because I think that's something that G2 needs to think about before you go down this path. You know, as you're sitting back and working through things, and everybody's always listening, make sure that you're also thinking about, is this what you want, or would you rather have some other kind of role within that business? And it is a totally different role to take that kind of leadership role. And there's a lot that comes with it, and you kind of have to make sure that you're committed to it and that it's something that you really want, because it might not be, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. If that's not what you want, then there's other things you can do. You can bring in outside help. You can hire someone else. You know, you can maintain a different role in your firm. So don't try to force it if that's not what's right for you and that's not what you want. In my situation, you know, I think I felt like I was going to be that successor, but it took me some time to understand and be comfortable and be confident that that's what I really wanted, and that's the role that I feel I'd be most comfortable in going forward. So, you know, don't try to force yourself into something that isn't a right fit.
Great point there, Chris. I think that's really valuable, and I'm going to touch back on that in a second, I think. Just want to start off first with what Eric talked about regarding this vulnerability. I think that's so key. I think that, as you both said, the founder tends to be, the founder is that personality, that controller, that is the business. Their lives are generally intertwined with the business, with G2 not taking anything away from their capabilities or their potential success within the firm, but the mentality and the intertwining of the personality and lifestyle is usually a little more separated, not only because they've come into it initially as a job, but maybe even more just generationally focused. So the ability for that founder to be vulnerable, to sit down and really share their feelings and goals, I think is critical. I think the other thing that was brought up is this third-party idea is clearly going to result, in my opinion, in some better outcomes. Having somebody who's been there, done that, and who's caring and sensitive to be able to guide the conversation, if for no other reason just to create the structure, but more importantly to add in the insight, the thoughtful questions, the sensitivity to both parties, the ability to sort of even be a communicator and a translator of feelings and thoughts, not to mention all the technical knowledge, is just going to be a wonderful idea. And this sort of, for me, brings up the concept of financial planning, right? We talk about how our clients should do plans and financial plans before they take action. And the idea that, Chris, as you talked about with your dad, not only from the idea of a new prospect coming in, is this the future of the firm, but even other elements that were talked about as to where the firm's going to grow. I think that, Eric, that you brought up, the firm should almost do their plan in conjunction with this. It doesn't have to be a 50-page strategic plan, but at least even a one-page, where do we see the firm going, so that we're all on the same page. And I think that gives tremendous energy and focus and enthusiasm to the succession plan once that's in place, as opposed to operating from a different position of maybe fear or need or requirement to do something. So, wow, we really got a lot of that last piece that we talked about, and think that some really good feelings and ideas have come from that session. Just because we only have a certain amount of time that we can go into, I guess what I'd like to do now is, from your perspectives, you could take this wherever you want to go, guys. You could either, A, if you could have done things differently, what would you have done differently so far, at least in the process? Eric, you're obviously a lot further along and done with that, maybe even starting to focus on G3 in your firm. And Chris, as you're still in this process of this transition, you know, so far, what would you have wished for or done differently along the way? And then the other piece is, how do you feel about advising G1? If there was something that you could say to all the G1 listeners of our podcast, what would you say to them as sort of something that, you know, they need to really keep in mind as they move forward? And Eric, if you could start us off, like I said, either one of those or both of those, give us a shot.
Sure. So I'll start with talking to the founders, right? Having worked with one for 17 years and, you know, right up front and center, kind of watching all this unfold and really being part of that story. I mean, I care a lot about John Henry. He was one of the first mentors I'd ever had. And it was painful to watch. I knew at times it was really hard for him, just like it was hard for me. And I think, so I'm going to give you three things that are really good, I think, for founders to consider. So one is commit to some type of strategic absence. What I mean by that is not just a vacation, but as you decide to be away from the office, but then turn over the keys to someone else to make decisions, just even if it's in small areas, so that they can be comfortable making some of those decisions without you there, even if you're just gone for a week, but some type of a strategic absence, not just a vacation, but an actual strategic absence, saying, I'm going to be gone, and I want you to kind of handle these things while I'm gone because I trust you. Like, so instilling that trust from an operational standpoint, that was very helpful to me because John Henry did that for me. So it affirmed kind of my role in the business. The other is, it's what we do for clients all day long, is calculate your enough. Like, what is your enough? From a financial standpoint, because that can get in the way of a lot of these plans that were coming to fruition, is that even us as planners aren't planning for our own retirement, our own next stage of our careers or financial independence. And so do a good job of calculating your enough so it takes some pressure off the succession plan itself, because you know what your target is. And the last thing is, consider what your deal breakers are. Like, what are the emotional parts of being the founder that make it so that you won't budge on something? Meaning, you know, I really want to be able to have this role that allows me to do these things as an ambassador of the firm, but I could care less about running the investment policy committee. So what are the deal breakers to succession that usually have to do with emotional things like your identity and how you think yourself as being a valuable person in the community? So those are the three things I would talk to founders about, because those are the things I spent a lot of time in discussions with John Henry about. And those seemed to be helpful to us as a business. Was there were times he'd take a strategic absence. He spent time trying to figure out what his enough was. So as the firm grew, he was comfortable owning a smaller piece of a bigger pie. And then the emotional pieces were having a kind of a network of people that were around him to also speak into him and affirm his value. So those are the things I'd talk to the founders about. On the things to do differently or looking back in the rearview mirror, I was afraid a lot more than I needed to be. And I think as a successor and a Generation 2 person, there's some unknown to you didn't found the company, you didn't take the initial risk. What if I can't do this? And so there were times where I probably needed to go to John Henry and just be more transparent with him about my own fears of taking over. Even though in his eyes he probably looked at me and thought maybe I had it all. I knew I was comfortable doing it. But it probably would have gone even smoother if I'd have gone to him earlier on and tried to be less confident and actually was more humble around, you know, I really feel lost about this. And I know we think we have this plan orchestrated, but I'm sitting in my office trying to figure out how in the world I'm going to do this to honor you. Because I really wanted to honor him and have the business live beyond him. I mean, it's been a little over 3 years since he's retired and is separated from the business, but the business is doing really great. And I feel like that responsibility is heavy. And I think I could have done a better job having those conversations with him to probably engage him in where I was as concerned about whether I could do the job or not.
Those are great points, Eric, and I completely agree with them. And I think that part of my answer would be that having those conversations as well is important. I think we both myself and my dad hesitated a little longer than maybe we should have. And I think my advice, so looking back on what we've where we've come from and how we've gotten to where we are now, you know, what I would change and what advice I would give to other G2 members is kind of intertwined. And that's really to shift your mentality sooner into that ownership attitude, having that mentality that you're an owner, even if you're not an owner yet. To me, it's been a shift where when I got here, I was an employee and I was doing things the way they'd always been done. I stepped right in from a big public accounting firm where, you know, I did what I was told to do, and that was my work. And I came in, clocked in, clocked out, and, you know, that's how I started. And I think at some point, I don't think that was I didn't see the light and have this realization, but over time I came to understand that I needed to take on more of that leadership role. And I stepped back and looked at what my dad had built. And it was this great foundation, this great house that he had built, but I felt like we could take it to another level together and that I could take it into the future. So maybe, you know, we're designing the interior of the house and we're moving rooms around and we're putting in windows and we're putting the finishing touches on this house that he spent 20 years building and building that foundation. And once I shifted my own mindset and my own mentality from being just an employee to being someone who wants to take the firm into the next level and who's going to benefit from the growth of the firm, I think I saw myself take on a different role, both with clients and with our staff. You know, I've taken on more of a direct role in managing who's doing what and what clients people are working on and bringing in interns and running that program and upgrading our technology and increasing our operational efficiency and making our client experience better. So I think if I had stayed in that role of just being an employee and just doing what we've always done, I would not have made that shift and I would not have taken the next step to where we needed to go. So I think we can often get stuck in that role and, you know, we like things the way they are and it's easier to keep things the way they are than to change. And we go through this over and over again in many different areas of our business, but you need to change and you need someone to spark that change. And it can be gradual, but you need to have that mentality that you're going to change things and that you're going to make things better in the future because it's going to benefit you NG1, and they will see that, and it will take them time to come to grips with that and to start to let go of different things. But the more you take on that kind of role where you're the leader and you're the lead advisor with the client, and the client starts to see you as that leader and they come to you instead of the G1, you know, the easier that transition will be. So I think that would be my recommendation, is just to try to shift that mentality to being an owner even before you become an owner.
Well, this is great. I can clearly see that we've really just scratched the surface of the different issues that go on here. And, you know, there's some funny visuals that I have in my head that I think really give light to the complexity of the, and the evolution of this. For Eric, it's truly you with the clipboard being Radar, and that testament to MASH, the TV series, and where you've gone to from there. And the skills, though, that were more important, which is why you brought that story up of the clipboard and having those skills around the organizational elements of the firm and where that's brought you today. I mean, that's pretty powerful for me. For you, Chris, the idea of me seeing Lyle in the air balloon in Turkey and you at afar with sort of this thought in your mind, you know, about what's going to happen next and how that can be a driver and a factor for people in developing a succession plan as well. And all the different elements here that from our conversations that just show this is really a really deep issue. And as I said, we've just sort of scratched the surface. So I'm excited realizing that there's even more potential for us to take this even farther. So, but I also want to thank you so much, both of you, for being on this podcast and for sharing your personal stories and opening up with all the listeners today. I can't thank you both enough, and I imagine the listeners are as well, because your personal stories are helping them move forward in their plans. So thank you. On behalf of the PFP section, this has been Michael Goodman. If you enjoyed this podcast, I highly encourage you to visit the PFP section website and access more practice management and succession planning resources. Stay tuned for Sarah Bradley, who will tell you how to find these valuable resources. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for sharing with our community of listeners. Want more information, resources, tools, and guidance on technical and practice management topics? Visit aicpa.org/PFP and check out the show notes for this episode as well. So if you're not already a member, think about joining the PFP section, which is designed to save you time, help you best serve your clients, and take your financial planning practice to the next level. You'll gain access to a robust selection of high-quality technical and practice management resources like guides, 24/7 access to an online learning library, client communication and education tools, up to 8 hours of free CPE, and more. Don't forget to leave us a review so we can continue bringing valuable and relevant content. And subscribe to our podcast channel so you don't miss an episode. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to next time.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered, and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.